Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Where does greatness come from? Why was Ted Williams the greatest hitter in the history of baseball? What made Mozart one of the history's most talented composers? And why was Shakespeare such a brilliant writer? The typical answer most people give is that greatness is innate. You're either born with certain gifts and talents, or you're not. But recent research suggests otherwise. Greatness is in fact made through years of hard, deliberate practice. My guest today has been on the forefront of this research on the science of expertise. His name is Anders Ericsson. He's a professor of psychology at Florida State University. He, along with co-author Robert Poole, have recently published a book highlighting Ericsson's research into the true nature and malleability of talent. It's called Peak: Secrets from the New Science of Expertise. And today on the show, Anders and I discuss the common misconceptions people have about talent, why the way most people practice leads to mediocre results, and how you can start implementing deliberate practice in your life to master any domain you choose. Great podcast with a lot of actionable points. After you listen to the show, make sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/peak for links to resources to delve deeper into this topic. So without further ado, Anders Ericsson and Peak. Okay, Professor Anders Ericsson, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, I've long been a fan of your work. You've done a lot of research about expertise, talent, deliberate practice. But the thing is, I've read about your work from other people writing about your work. There's lots of books about the research you've done. But you have a new book out where you, along with your co-author, Robert Poole, talk about the research you've dedicated your career to and the sort of the science of expertise. The book's called Peak. Before we get into the details of it, I'm curious, at what point in your career did you start focusing on what makes experts experts, and why did you decide to focus on that in your academic or your psychological academic career?
Well, you know, I think we can go back quite a bit of time, even to high school, where, you know, I was really interested in how people were thinking, and I was interested in how scientists were able to kind of come up with their discoveries. And so I think I've had that interest in understanding how some people seem to be able to think in a way that allows them to be more successful and productive. So actually, when I started to become an engineer in nuclear physics, and then I kind of got more interested in the thinking part, so I moved over to study psychology. And my first work was essentially just having people think out loud while they were solving, you know, relatively simple problems. But what really fascinated me was, you know, how different people think, and how many also similarities there are in how people have to think in order to successfully solve problems. So that was kind of the starting point of just studying thinking. And then I got an opportunity to go to the United States for a postdoc. And there I basically then started the work that we describe in the book on, you know, taking a regular college student and just seeing, you know, what is it that happens if somebody gets a lot of training on a particular task? In this case, you know, your short-term memory, how much can you actually, you know, be able to repeat back exactly? And what is it that happens to the thinking while you're actually improving your performance?
Right, because I mean that research is interesting because it's, you know, sort of it's about working memory, and there's sort of like there's long thought there's a limit to it, right? Like you can only maintain 7 bits of information in your working memory. That's why phone numbers are probably 7 digits long. But through your experiments, you're able to help this one guy memorize digits, you know, number strands that were hundreds of digits long.
Right. The first subject was able to do a little bit over 80 digits when you read them 1 per second. And I guess we had another, his friend, we trained him, and he was able to get up to 110 digits. But I think the key finding was that if you're trying to find ways here of expanding how much you can hold on to, and we found that people actually were storing it in long-term memory by making associations to things that they already knew. And our two subjects were using running times as a primary way of actually making sense of 3- and 4-digit numbers. But I think the kind of the key here is that if you commit to applying now the and building skill in a given domain, and we found the same kind of finding here in chess and other types of domains, that the experts were actually able now to have a more expanded working memory, so they could keep track of what was happening, and they could actually think and reason about what they might want to do in a way that was very dependent now on the particular domain. So I think that's kind of maybe one of the most interesting findings here, is that when you focus your training on a particular domain, it seems that there's really no clear limit on how much information you can be able to sort of consider as you have engaged in training for an extended period of time.
Okay, and we'll get later more into detail about this domain specificity of practicing and getting better. But before we get into like why we're able to do this, why we're able to, you know, we have limitless possibilities of getting better in a task. I think it'd be useful to kind of talk about sort of the common misconceptions that people have about expertise and talent. So what are those most, the common misconceptions that people do have about their ability to become better or you know, develop their talent?
Well, you know, I think basically the most important kind of misconception is that you really have to have innate talent to even bother to try to become or try to become an expert performer. And I think, you know, we've now reviewed a lot of research that shows that basically that kind of idea here that you show something before you actually started engaging in training, it's not well supported, and we kind of argue that it's probably more important for you to kind of assume here that there aren't any innate gifts that you need to kind of discover by sampling all sorts of activities. It's more important that you kind of find a domain here where you would have support and help and be interested, and it's really up to you to build that performance that eventually then will, you know, allow you to reach very high levels.
Right. And you highlight examples of skills that were once thought to be just innate, natural talent. For example, perfect pitch was thought to be something that you were just born with. But you and your researchers, fellow researchers, have found that, no, you can actually, through practice, develop perfect pitch.
Right. Perfect pitch is kind of a weird ability that people found that some musicians had. So if you basically play a tone on the piano, they can actually tell you exactly what tone that is. And maybe even more impressively, if you know, make a sound, they can actually tell you what frequency that sound actually corresponded to in terms of notes. And one of the things that was sort of initially a kind of supporting that view that, you know, this is something that you either have and you don't, and it's sort of innate, was that basically when older adults tried to acquire this, they found it extremely difficult and basically not something that would be easily acquired. And then research started to look at basically the development. And one of the things that people noticed was that the musicians that acquired this tended to actually had started playing music at an early age. And now I think it's pretty compelling evidence that there's an age period between 3 years and 5 years where it seems like any child, if you give them the appropriate training, will be able to acquire this skill. As you get older, it's almost like the brain is now getting into a different developmental phase where it's actually, you know, processing sound in terms of relationships. So we talk about relative pitch, where you can judge two pitches and argue, you know, whether they're the same and how they're different, which is a quite different process from just getting a single note.
Right. But that is to say, though, even as adults, it is possible with the right kind of training to move beyond just relative pitch, but actually acquire perfect pitch.
There are demonstrations of people who've been able to do that with very extended training. You know, they never really reach kind of the most extreme level of perfect pitch, but, you know, they certainly were able to do it. And what was interesting is that when they did it, they actually had to kind of memorize a note, or basically they needed some kind of fixed reference point. And basically that was kind of the focus of the training, of being able to kind of self-generate a standard that would allow you now to compare the note that you heard with your internal standard.
Right. And going back to this idea that you know, children between the ages of 3 and 5, their brain is sort of open to, you know, shaping through practice. You talk about in the book how this is probably why Beethoven was such a musical prodigy. A lot of times we think that, oh, he just had this genius that he was born with. But you kind of show throughout the book that, you know, in fact, Beethoven at a very young age began extensive musical training under the hand of his father that allowed him to become the Beethoven that we know today.
Right. I think we were talking about Mozart.
Oh, yeah, correct.
You
Mozart.
Could probably make a related argument about Beethoven. But Mozart was famous for actually being one of the first documented cases here of this perfect pitch, you know, where he was able to name notes when they were presented in isolation. And obviously Mozart is viewed as a pretty remarkable musician. In the book, we kind of really, you know, talk a little bit about when you compare what Mozart was able to do in terms of playing music, it turns out that today's Suzuki-trained music students, that they actually, in some ways, were even able to reach more prodigious level than Mozart. So it's not, you know, that Mozart was doing something that nobody else could replicate. And we also talk about the fact that Mozart's father, you know, may actually have been able to help Mozart with the early compositions. So when we're really talking about Mozart's ability to, you know, write compositions by himself, we're talking about something that was done when he was, you know, in late adolescence.
So, I mean, this is amazing. This, what your research is showing is that, you know, talent isn't innate. You know, we can actually, if we want to, through our willpower and our choice and our commitment, we can improve ourselves in specific skills through a certain kind of practice, which we'll talk about later on. But so if practice is the key to becoming an expert, a lot of people practice, you know, say if they're a tennis player and they go to the courts every weekend and they play tennis, they think that's practice. But you argue in the book they're not really practicing effectively. So how is it that most people have practiced that kind of leads them to sort of this middling performance that they never actually get to expert level?
Yeah, and I think most people know people who've been playing golf two or three times a week for 20, 30 years, and they don't seem to be getting any better. And I guess what the probably the most important point that we make in this book is, you know, once you look at what people do, and I think it's somewhat similar with people who are, you know, engaged in the same profession for decades, they tend to just keep doing what they have been doing, and they're just doing more of it. And I think what we show here, you know, review after review, just basically the length of time that you've been spending in a domain, if we exclude the first year or two, when you actually do improve, when you're kind of getting into the domain, it doesn't seem like additional experience is really improving your ability to, you know, be effective here as a doctor in terms of how well your patients are doing, or if you're a teacher, how well you can get your students to improve their academic performance, and you can go wrong the line. And even when it comes to just playing chess, if you're a tournament player, the amount of time that you've been spending playing chess with your club friends does not seem to improve your performance in chess. So basically, just getting more experience is not automatically making you better.
Gotcha. And going back to that research on the doctors, you even found studies, research that doctors' performance actually declines with age.
Right. If we're talking about something like diagnosing heart sounds, it actually turns out that the ability of a doctor to diagnose tape recordings here, where we actually know what the patient's problem was, actually decreases as a function of how long they've been out practicing since they graduated.
Yeah, that was really interesting. So, okay, if you want to get better at golf or tennis or whatever skill you want to get better at, it's not enough just to go play a lot. You argue that you need to take your practice to something you call purposeful practice. So what's involved with purposeful practice?
Well, you know, so we kind of argue that the ideal type of practice is if you have a teacher who observes you performing, say, you know, watching you play tennis in a doubles game or whatever. And then, you know, they will actually notice here that when you get an opportunity to do a backhand volley or something, you know, that you basically are very unlikely to be successful. Now, if you just keep on playing, the opportunities here for backhand volley is going to come, you know, when you're not really ready for it. So you're really not getting a very good chance here of developing better skills at improving that. So what we're arguing is, well, if a teacher observed you and now says, okay, so let's now train your backhand volley. Now the coach can basically have you stand there ready to take a backhand volley, and you keep doing that until you're, you know, really having control over your shot, and then basically make you step back and, you know, make it harder for you. So incrementally, you're building up your skill of actually being able to do the backhand volley. And the argument is that even if you have just a couple of hours training with a coach under those conditions, that's going to improve your backhand volley so much more than spending, you know, years or even decades of doubles tennis.
So it's a matter of just honing in on a very specific skill and then purposely working on that skill.
Right. And integrating it into what you would normally do, because, you know, you don't want to make that change in a way that you're not relying on it when you're actually playing. But that general principle here, and that's true for musicians. So you have a musician who's preparing a piece for a public performance, and there's one section here where they have real difficulty, you know, really controlling and keeping up the tempo and the kind of variations here in loudness that is desired. Well, then you basically try to make that the target of practice. So, you know, the teacher would recommend here, maybe you would need to do some exercises to be able to speed up now, basically certain types of finger combinations. And then you kind of keep working on it. And then eventually you embed that now in your performance. And now you can actually perform it at a higher level than you could previously.
So what's going on in our brain when we practice purposefully?
Well, the argument is that a skilled performer, and this is really key to be able to practice by yourself, you know, you're going to be able to sort of have an idea of what it is that you're aspiring to do. And then, you know the kind of sequence of finger movements that you're going to producing. And then you also need to be able to kind of listen to what it sounds like, because you basically need to have some way of knowing if you're getting closer to what you're trying to achieve. And by iterating like that, maybe for hours, you can basically now figure out ways in which you will be able to achieve that goal. So now you can produce something that sounds like what the teacher wanted you to be able to produce, and you can kind of hear that you're actually able to do that.
And so even though purposeful practice is a step up from just sort of random practice that you might do, right? You play, go to the tennis court, go to the golf course. You say in the book, though, that purposeful practice still has limits. What are the limits of purposeful practice?
Well, you know, purposeful practice, the way we define it, is that you have a goal and you're actually trying to change a specific aspect. Now, you don't necessarily know if that goal is the best. And just to take one example here, let's assume that you're playing basketball and you want to learn how to dunk, you know, and one way to kind of improve now your ability to get higher up in the air, you know, would be to kind of keep jumping up and down. Now, it turns out that there's now kind of research showing that the most effective way of actually improving the height of your jump is not jumping more, but is essentially working with weights. So you actually are lifting weights, and that now gives the stimulus to your legs, you know, so you're actually explosively getting up with the weight, and that now puts much more pressure on your legs. And that type of training will eventually allow you now to actually get more success here in increasing your jumping height. So when we talk about deliberate practice, we argue that when the practice is actually recommended and the coach is actually diagnosing and saying, well, you know, at your current level of performance, one thing that you can actually do to improve here within the next couple of weeks is by basically improving this. So let's focus in on trying to improve this. And here is some training activities that would allow you now to repeat and get immediate feedback here on your success. So once we have a teacher who actually has proven by bringing other people up to the level that you're aspiring to be at, then we're talking about deliberate practice, because not only are you doing purposeful practice, but you're actually doing the kinds of sequence of purposeful practice that prior experience have shown is associated with you being able to reach a higher level of performance.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, so that's a key point there. So deliberate practice requires that the results are, you can replicate the results.
Right, and basically that, you know, the knowledge and training, and I guess in music we have several hundred years of basically people trying to acquire very high level of skill on various instruments. So they've now developed training activities that are effective here of improving various things like, for example, the speed of combinations, the ability to, you know, move your hand in jumps and stuff like that. So as long as there is basically this science support that a given activity will actually improve something better, then we're actually calling that deliberate practice, because a coach is more or less able to, because that coach have actually seen other people reaching these higher levels of performance. And in some ways, I mean, that's kind of the magic of skill. You know, you're at a given level, and the question is, can you get to this higher level? Well, if you see 10 other people who were at your level, who actually now, with the help of this coach, been able to reach this higher level, then I think most people would be convinced here, you know, that it seems likely here that this type of training will actually get me to this higher point.
Gotcha. So, you know, because the deliberate practice requires you to focus on tasks or practices that we know based on research will get you better. What are the other principles of deliberate practice?
Well, you know, they basically, I guess, for the purposeful practice, you know, you need to have a goal, and you need to have a training activity that allows you now to kind of keep repeating and refining what you're doing, so you gradually will now be able to reach that goal. And you also need to have the opportunities here to kind of reflect on what happened when you tried to do something slightly different, to assess here whether that really could be a path for you to reach this higher level of performance. So this idea here that you really need to do something, you get immediate feedback about whether this is actually now closer to the goal, and basically you keep refining. And we find that, you know, so much of education and training doesn't really meet that criterion for purposeful practice. So I guess if you go and listen to a lecture, or, you know, the coach is telling you about how to do things, that's very different from that individualized practice where you can actually do things and gradually improve your ability to do it. And so we basically argue here that most of the training that you see, even that's going on between teams, you know, contain a relatively small proportion of what we would call purposeful. And in particular, if you have only one coach to 40 soccer players or football players, then obviously very little is going to be individualized training. You know, the coach is going to be having everyone doing the same thing, and that may be useful perhaps to a few of the individuals, but you really are not kind of finding that optimal training difficulty that really would be effective for each individual.
So one thing I've read about deliberate practice, and, you know, the articles and books that I've written about it, is that it's hard. Deliberate practice is hard. It can be boring, monotonous. Why is that? Why does deliberate practice have to be hard in order for it to work?
Well, you know, one of the preconditions of deliberate practice is that the task that you're setting yourself out to achieve is not something that you can already do. So basically, it's almost like, quote, setting yourself up for failure, because there is a gap here between what you're trying to do and what you currently can do in a sort of consistent way.
Gotcha.
So anytime when you're actually trying to stretch yourself, you know, it's going to require a lot of concentration. And also it seems that unless you're really trying to reach for this higher level goal, basically just repeating doing things is not going to make a difference. So that's why, you know, deliberate practice almost by design is going to be difficult. And the number of times that you're not meeting the standard is going to be very high. And it is, you know, obviously once you get, so you can now actually reach this goal, then you're going to get that satisfaction of feeling now that you can actually do things that you couldn't do maybe a week earlier. And that is kind of enjoyable. But, you know, there's a long path before you get there. And what we find is that, you know, most of the musicians and other performers, they tend to have pretty stable practice schedule. So they, you know, actually decide to always, every day, you know, put in an hour or two or whatever in the morning, perhaps. So they don't really have to do what amateurs do. You know, am I going to go out and jog today? Maybe not. You know, maybe I'll do it tomorrow. These individuals have already made that commitment. And sometimes, you know, they practice together with other individuals. So they, you know, the coach would keep track of whether they practice or not. And then they're kind of focused here on this goal. So they're not asking themselves, do I want to keep doing this or not? You know, you're just engaged here in this process of trying to reach the goal that you set for yourself. And then when you're done and you have reached a goal, well, then you can relax and enjoy it. And a lot of people find that that kind of concentration is really enjoyable because it relaxes you. It's sort of, you're maximally focused during the training, but afterwards when you take the shower and stuff like that, you know, you feel this relaxation and you know, a very pleasurable, enjoyable feeling.
So is purposeful practice, deliberate practice, is it domain specific? Or if you, or is there sort of, can you increase your sort of generalized ability to improve performance in other areas by taking part in deliberate practice in one specific area?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I think it may depend a little bit on, you know, your level of skill. We know in some domains, I contributed to a study looking at world-class rhythmic gymnasts. And what they found in that case was that if you started, you know, training in ballet, you were much more likely here to be, you know, world-class when you were an adult gymnast than if you actually started training in gymnastics. Because basically the early training in gymnastics is much more, you know, free play where you tumble around and do things, whereas ballet has a little bit more structure where you, you know, learn how to keep your posture and keep your balance and so on. So I think early on, you know, there may be, you know, activities that could potentially benefit you, like being able to have the right kind of posture might actually be valuable in several different types of activities. However, as you get more and more skilled, I found less evidence that basically you would have that kind of general transfer. Even when people do weight training in domains, team sports, it seems that now the most effective weight training at the highly skilled levels, it's actually designed, you know, to get at strengthening the muscles in particular situations where, you know, increased strength would be particularly useful in that particular sport. But that obviously would not then be likely here to generalize across other types of sports.
Right. And so, I mean, you even talk about the chess players, you know, they can get really good at chess, but sometimes they don't get better in other activities that are similar to chess.
That's true. And, you know, and I think we need to kind of distinguish. It may be that a chess player, you know, when they start playing some other game, may be at an advantage compared to other players. But when it comes to actually transferring that high level of performance, I don't know of any evidence suggesting here that, you know, having been a world-class chess player, you know, would actually make you more likely here to, you know, be successful in this other game. So you somehow would be able to find some pathway here that would shortcut that training that's required for mastery of this new game. But, you know, I have to be honest here. Very few world-class chess players, as far as I know, have really taken on and tried to become world-class in bridge or, you know, whatever other game you would be thinking about. So basically, you know, that's one of the intriguing things is that it seems to be so time and energy and resource constrained to achieve world-class level in a single domain that it's extremely rare that individuals are able to reach that level in more than one domain.
Throughout the book, sort of the key part that you and Robert Poole carry throughout the entire book that's key to deliberate practice, why it works, is this idea of mental representations. What are mental representations and what role do they play in your theory of expertise?
Mental representations is sort of that kind of organizing feature that, and what we find is as you get better in a domain, you acquire this ability of being able to close your eyes and actually mentally kind of see a picture or kind of a mental image that you can manipulate and think about. So if you wanted to have a music piece sound like something, you know, you can hear that music piece before you start playing, and then you can also basically now use that image that you want it to sound like as kind of a input here to how you play it, and then you listen to it, and basically that ability of actually mentally, you know, listen to a piece of music and actually think about how you could do it slightly differently to get it to sound even better. That kind of imagery and that's what we basically refer to as mental representation. And I guess it's sort of like key to improvement. So if you don't know what you need, want it to sound like, or what you need, want to do, it's going to be very hard for you to be able to do that, right? So it seems that almost always people are able to hear differences, or when they look at other people, you know, doing something, they're aware of what the difference is between how to do it the right way with the best success and how they currently are doing. So that is kind of the starting point for you now to try to bridge that gap by engaging in training activities. So it's almost like your ability to see what needs to be changed is actually being developed in parallel with your increasing skill. And I think that's one of the things that I would emphasize here when it comes to training children and adolescents. You know, the parent and the coach really need to help the child and the adolescent to develop these representations, because they eventually need to be responsible for their continued development once they get to a point here where they can now do what their parent or teacher is able to do. They need to kind of continue that improvement if they're going to be competitive at the national and international level.
So yeah, it seems like that the coach or the teacher, they have the mental representations already and they're trying to impart that to their student. But how can individuals apply deliberate practice when they might not have a coach or a teacher available?
Well, I guess what you need at least is some kind of vision here of what it is that you would like to be able to do. And until you basically have a clear way of explicating what it is that you want to do and a method by which you will be able to tell if you can do that, then I think it's going to be really hard to design purposeful practice. But I think, you know, pretty much any kind of activity that we engage in, we can at least find factors that can be converted into measurement. So, for example, let's talk about, for example, a doctor that listens to a patient. And then the question is, does a doctor, would they be able to, after their interview with the patient, to actually recall and describe what it is that the patient was actually saying and what they were concerned with, and whether the patient really understood now how the recommended treatment would address the problem that they were experiencing. Now, that is sort of an activity you can have the doctor, after seeing a videotape, you know, try to really write down now, what was it that the patient was saying? And what they find is that some doctors, they're just so, you know, in their own mind, focused in on what the medical problem is, that they don't really have that ability of listening to the patient or what it is that they are, you know, having problems with. And I think basically that listening skills is something that, you know, we can evaluate relatively easily. And if we can evaluate it, we can also set up now training activities where you would be watching a series of videotapes, and we can kind of see here how your ability to actually, describe what the patient was saying during that interview.
So yeah, that's great. So this is, you're kind of showing how individuals can take sort of amorphous skills like good doctoring or business management, where there's not a specific skill that you can, you know, kind of pinpoint and say, if I work on this, I'll become a better business manager. But with this doctor example, you're showing that it is possible to apply deliberate practice even to more amorphous soft skills.
Right. You know, and I think another thing that doctors get training on is, how do you basically talk to a patient that you're going to have to tell that they have a very low probability of surviving for the next 6 months? And they actually have design now. So they're actually individuals that are trained to be patients. So you would have a doctor here now, you know, given an assignment here to convey to this actor patient, you know, and then basically that actor patient will try to behave in different ways that would now help the doctor realize what some of the issues and problems. And then you would have a coach who would actually be, you know, reviewing the videotape or the actual interaction that would then be able to help the doctor here pointing out, you know, here's something that you need to change. I mean, you need to really help this individual, you know, do the best of a very difficult situation. And what they find is that these difficult situations, if you get training in actually helping people through them, you know, you can do a much better job. So the patient actually now is able to more constructively deal with, you know, what would be in any case a very challenging situation.
So, Dr. Erickson, your idea of deliberate practice has been written about extensively. I've read the Talent Code or Talent is Overrated. They've written about it. But Malcolm Gladwell wrote about your work famously, and he came with this whole 10,000 hour rule. And it's often become synonymous with deliberate practice. But you devote an entire section, and you and Robert Poole devote an entire section detailing the misconceptions that people have about this rule. What are the misconceptions about the 10,000 hour rule?
I think the most important misconception is this idea that if you just keep doing something for 10,000 hours, you magically become an expert. And I guess Malcolm Gladwell was talking in his book here about the Beatles playing, you know, very, very extended periods in Hamburg. And he was arguing that maybe, you know, this thousands of hours of playing, you know, could possibly explain why the Beatles was developing into the music band that, you know, composed a lot of successful songs. I guess we are arguing here that you really need to link it. And I think in my own mind, and I think a lot of biographers of the Beatles would argue that, you know, their compositions, I mean, it wasn't like they were instrumentalists that played other people's music. I mean, their fame was and playing their own composed music that really made a major impact. So what we need to explain here is how these compositional skills were developed, and that's actually a different task. So in our work, and Gladwell was referring to it when he came up with this 10,000-hour rule, you know, we were talking about that activity that a music student is actually working by themselves in their, you know, training room, working on tasks that their music teacher has assigned them. So if we just count those hours where they're spending, you know, working by themselves on really trying to gradually improve their skill, that's the kind of time that we were talking about. And I think that idea here that the body would know when you actually have done 10,000 hours of something, you know, doesn't make sense. And it differs from domain to domain. And in fact, when I try to estimate the amount of time that musicians, pianists had practiced alone before they won an international piano competition, probably would be more closer to 20 to 25,000 hours of training. So there's several things here that I think are different. But I do think that Malcolm Gladwell did a good thing here by helping people believe that the way even the most talented become great is actually expending this very long period of time where they're actually working and trying to develop their skills. And anybody who's looking for, you know, a secret where they can become a world expert here after 5 hours of training, you know, I mean, that's sort of totally ridiculous. And I think we need to help people realize what the path is going to have to look like for them to be successful. And then they can make a choice, you know, are they seeing here that they would like to make that commitment, but essentially saying that they wouldn't be able to, or that they wouldn't be able to do it with 5 hours of training, you know, that's a different kind of idea. And all we can do, I think, in science is to help people see, give them the best possible information about the choices that they have about the careers that they might want to pursue.
Well, Dr. Erickson, this has been a fantastic conversation. Where can people learn more about the book Peak?
Well, I think maybe the best source is the Peak, the book in one word, .com. Robert Poole and his wife have set up a website where you can also, you know, get in contact with us, and also a lot of other connections here of related issues.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Anders Erickson, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
I really enjoyed talking to you. It was wonderful. Thank you.
My guest today was Anders Erickson. He's the co-author of the book Peak, The New Science of Expertise. You can find that on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can also go to Peak the Book for more information about the book. Also, check out the show notes at aom.is/peak for links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show and have gotten something out of it, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes. It really helps us out a lot. As always, I appreciate the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.